The real problem is gaining acceptance for whistling as a legitimate musical art form. And, you know, that's kind of my mission in life.
You set out to do a lighthearted exploration of whistling and music in generations past. And what do you find? But serious whistlers at work right now. Like Steve the Whistler Herbst, for example.
I'd like to see a whistler's chair in the symphony orchestras of the world.
See what I mean? But even a pro whistler like Steve admits that the heyday of whistling was a long time ago. You can trace whistlers back to the earliest days of recording, when the sound of a whistler really cut through the very primitive recording techniques of the ear. This one's from the early 20th century, and it's typical of the period, observes whistler and historian Mitch Heider.
There's a lot of chirping and songs that were associated with birds.
There was even a school in L.A. at the time, Miss Woodward's School of Artistic Whistling.
She had exercises, kind of a... and she would do the melody of a song and just add a little...
Once whistling found its way into popular music, Arthur Pryor and his orchestra had a hit with The Whistler and His Dog in the mid-20s. And only a couple of years later, the very first talkie, the jazz singer with Al Jolson, featured a long whistling solo in that warbling style. But the golden age of whistling was in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, when something about the sound and the spirit of the whistler just clicked with a certain idea about American life, particularly when people started struggling in the 30s.
Most famously, Whistling in the Dark, which is a very big popular song around 1931, 32.
Will Friedwald writes about jazz and popular music.
There are zillions of recordings of that song. It's very big in the Depression, the idea of whistling in the dark.
Strolling in the park without a single thing to do. The night is black and I am blue. That's why I'm whistling in the dark.
In those years, it went beyond the sound of the whistler. It was about the mystique of the whistler. Not a care in the world, just walking along, doing his thing. This is from 1934.
Lend an ear, and you'll hear Whistling Joe from Kokomo.
Now he doesn't hurry, he doesn't worry, hasn't got a care.
Even in songs where there's nothing in the lyric or nothing in the song itself that dictates that it should be whistled, but, you know, Ted Weems and his orchestra were very famous for having a lot of whistling records, and their famous whistler was a singer and a musician named Elmo Tanner, and his big record was Heartaches.
This one kind of combines the bird style with the carefree guy style from the late 30s. Bing Crosby had that combination, too.
The way, like, Bing Crosby uses it, it's sort of an early equivalent of scat singing. When you want to improvise vocally, Crosby and people in that period were just as likely pretty much to do it by whistling as they were to do it with, like, you know, nonsense, you know, scat syllables. Crosby, who wasn't an instrumentalist, was able to, you know, work as if he were a horn player when he whistled, and he does it very well, very, very musical. It establishes a very intimate mood.
In fact, by this time, it was practically a genre, a real part of the pop music world, truly a golden age.
This was an era where you actually had whistlers traveling with the big bands. You know, you'd see the trumpet player stand up behind the little bandstand and do a solo, and he'd sit down. And well, they also had whistlers who traveled with these bands and would come out in the front and perform as a solo artist. And they were, you know, quite well known. They had albums of their own that sold.
There was a blind whistler called Fred Lowry and a guy who did novelty sounds and whistling called Perv Pollen.
There are jazz whistlers, there's country whistlers, there's blues whistlers, there's hillbilly whistlers, there's vaudeville whistlers, there's Tin Pan Alley, there's whistling in the context of Broadway shows, there's whistling in the context of, you know, big swing bands and pop vocals.
And like all proper popular culture, the art of the whistle found its way into movies. Not just Al Jolson, but the Seven Dwarfs, the Marx Brothers. Elvis whistled in Kid Galahad. And John Wayne's character whistled in a 50s movie called The High and the Mighty. In that early disaster film about a troubled flight and its unflappable whistling co-pilot, whistling was practically a character in the movie.
I heard you whistling, and I said to myself, only one guy does that just so. I'd know that ugly face of yours anywhere.
A then-famous whistler called Muzzy Marcellino did the solos. The whistled theme song by Dmitri Tiomkin was a mega-hit of that moment, and the score won the Academy Award that year, 1954. As for where whistling went after that, well, Johnny Carson celebrated the astonishing jazz whistling of Ron McCroby on The Tonight Show. But music had changed, and so had the world. Maybe we didn't think we could whistle ourselves out of a tight spot anymore. Maybe the loner, whistling, hands in pockets, seemed more ominous than friendly. So when it came back in Morricone's Western scores, it was more of a sound effect than a spirit. But it did capture something that cut through, just as the bird whistling had 50 years before.
Now when you hear those things, you definitely think about cowboys and Indians and Clint Eastwood in The Poncho when I hear that Morricone score with the whistling, even though I might be thinking about an Italian interpretation of it.
I don't think it's nice, you laughing.
There's that loner again, somebody's idea of an American, whistling in the dark. For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fishko.
Go!